Erev Tov, good evening, everybody. We're going to continue. We're averaging a perek a week, which is I'm very happy about because it means that we can actually finish the sefer in good time. And this week we really come across a story that is very well known. And it's a haftarah, in fact, for Parshat Shmini. So we read this story once a year in shul. It's obvious, there's obvious connection to the parsha, as we'll see in a minute. And it throws up a number of issues. And again, by way of introduction, before we just begin chapter 6, page 163, I want to deal with one specific introduction and maybe a couple of other points which we need to know before we learn this parsha. All the way through our shiurim, this goes right back almost to the beginning of the emergence of David HaMelech, which is the middle of Shmuel Aleph. We have been trying to come to terms with the character of David. David is a man who, began his life seemingly rejected by the family. You know, we went through all of that, and he was a shepherd, which wasn't a particularly noble profession, much against our normal understanding. It's clear there that he was sent out into the field to sort of keep him out of the house, keep him away. And of course, at that time, he was developing his relationship with God. And it's interesting, there are a number of Meforshim of the modern school of teachers in Israel, Rav Yigal Ariel, who is a teacher in the north of Israel, and Rav Bachrach, who taught in Michlala, and amongst others, who talk about the character of David. And they seem to come to the same conclusion. And just to explain this, it's terminology that you may have come across before, or possibly not. If you're into sort of Hasidic writings, and if you're into a bit of Kabbalistic writing, you may have heard these phrases before. The question is asked, what is the difference between, let's say, David and Shlomo? How do we define David's way of serving God and Shlomo's way of serving God? Shlomo built the temple. He built a phenomenal structure. And you read the description, and it just is mind-blowing. And yet, you've got David HaMelech, and he did what he did. In fact, it's interesting, the Gemara says that Shlomo, on the day of the bringing, of starting the process of the temple, I think it was maybe the day of dedication, I remember now, it says he brought 1,000 korbanot, 1,000. And it says, the Gemara says, that one tehillim of David was more precious in the eyes of God than the 1,000 sacrifices of Shlomo. That's the rabbinic statement. And the question is, what do they mean? What do they mean? I mean, 1,000 korbanot, I mean, it just defies the imagination. 1,000 animals, right? And yet, David's one tehillim seems to have a higher place than Shlomo's sacrifices. And it's not just because David is the father of Shlomo. There's a bit more to it than that. And the Rabbanim, they all say the same thing, that there's two types of service of God. There's the service of God which Shlomo represents, which essentially is, for most of us, the way that we try and do it, which is called in it's actually an Aramaic phrase, itaruta dilatata, isarusa dilasata. It's coming from the ground up. What does that mean? It means that you take the resources around you, the material world, and you elevate them into something spiritual. You take leather and you turn it into straps and boxes of tefillin. You take a parchment and you write on it holy words, and it becomes a mezuzah, becomes a sefer Torah. You know, and so on and so forth. You take wool and you spin it, and all of a sudden it becomes something holy. It sits it. And so on. This is the derech which essentially Shlomo HaMelech represented. Shlomo took the best of the material world and he tried to elevate it into something spiritual. And without going too much into Shlomo, because that's for another time, and we'll talk a bit about Shir HaShirim one day, because that's part of what Shlomo is all about, without sort of giving too much away at this point, I just, by way of contrast, when we talk about David, and this is what we have to come to terms with in chapter 6, Perek Vav, David is the absolute opposite of this, in the sense that his hitorerut, the way that he serves God, is called in the classic terminology, itaruta de la eila. It's a word that we use in the Kaddish, la eila, and during Yom Kippur, eila, la eila mikol b'chata, right? The eila means from above. Itaruta de la eila means that David was inspired to the highest levels of spiritual achievement from the beginning. David aimed to get as close to God as he possibly could. And he was totally, I would say almost totally, without any trappings of materialism. We don't read about a palace. We don't read about, you know, the gorgeous surroundings that, for instance, with Shlomo, 1,000 wives, you know, and all the harem and everything that he had. That, for David, doesn't exist. David is a man who is very much, when it comes to the material world, it's almost irrelevant to him. What is relevant to him is his relationship to God. And it's so elevated, and it's so high, and it's so intense, that very often, if you meet people like this, and sometimes, you know, go to Tzvat, and you'll bump into people who are like this to this very day. You'll meet, you know, the Braslavers up there, who spend time in the forests, and they go out. And they hit bodudut. The Reb Nachman was very much into this. The idea that you spend time by yourself, communing with, used to say communing with nature, but in this case it's communing with God. You're having this kind of relationship to God which is very, very pure. It's breaking away from all of the bounds of the material world and trying to connect to God in the most spiritual way possible. That's David HaMelech. And if it doesn't make sense to us, don't worry about it. Because I honestly am going to argue that his wife never understood it either. Michal, we're going to read in this chapter the famous story that she sees David dancing in front of the Aron HaKodesh. She doesn't know what he's doing. She doesn't understand what David is really doing, what he's performing, what he's doing. She just doesn't get it. And it's so interesting that when we try to compare, we try to understand. If you appreciate this element of David HaMelech's character, it's Aruta de la Ela, that he's aiming for the highest level of spirituality to bring down the influence from heaven. Like in this week's parsha, the ladder. Reb Chaim Volozhiner says in Nefesh HaChaim, the ladder represents the neshama. The way the neshama actually receives this influence from God. Right, he gives a very deep explanation in Nefesh HaChaim, and it's just something to look up there. And it's really what we're saying with David. David is his neshama, his ladder is ready up in the heavens, and he's bringing down all of the influence that he can from this upper level of God, whatever that means, into the physical world, into the world around us. And David is a very interesting person, but very difficult to understand. If you meet these very godly people, which you may meet, I would argue that sometimes even outside the Jewish tradition, you'll find people like this. People who sort of in other religious traditions are very much secluded. They're away from the material world because they want to sort of commune, connect with God in a more spiritual way. It's just very fascinating that this is a massive difference between Shlomo and David. Yeah. What's the, in what sense?
In terms of the woman, was it truly consistent?
Well, that's one issue that David will have to come to terms with in terms of his...
Because if we see these people that you're talking about, yeah, godly, spiritual, we don't expect them, yeah, to rise with David.
And my argument is that is the absolute greatness of David, that he's also human. That he can achieve this closeness to God and he can act as a human being at the same time. He's got emotional faults, all right? He's got real emotional issues. Now you'll say to me, all right, explaining that, Rav Dester talks about the Bathsheba thing as a Ruach HaKodesh, it's a Nevuah of David, that he knows that this is the woman he's got to marry, right? Without going into the whole explanation. But in other words, even within the relationships that he has, there is this dimension of intense spirituality, intense. David is very intense, and he's intense, I suppose, in a way you can understand it. I would explain it because he's spending so much time warring and so much time fighting. You know, we just left off the Plishtim last week. He's done them in, finally. It took him a long time. So this is a man who, you can imagine in battle, it must have been the most miserable existence, fighting these horrible battles the whole time, where, you know, it's hand-to-hand combat and everything else. And what does David do to try and fortify himself? He sees God in everything that happens to him, in every detail. All right, so this is what I'm going to say at the moment without getting into too much detail, but when we get to chapter 11, you'll see that this is becomes more relevant. If you understand what I said, and if it makes sense, that there's literally two approaches, the Taruta de la Ela of David, the Hitorarut, the way that David connects to God from the highest level, bringing down that influence into the world, which I would add, by the way, is what we do on Sukkot, the Na'anuim, when we shake the lulav, we shake it up and down, up and down. We're trying to bring that influence into the world by shaking the lulav. whether we understand it or not, whether it makes sense to us or not. But that's essentially what the deeper meaning of what the whole story of what we do in Sukkot is about. Then that is something that I think will help us to come to terms with what goes on in chapter 6. Second thing that I just wanted to add is really about the whole question of what happens here to a gentleman called Uzzah. Uzzah is a guy who, you'll see, has a very unfortunate end. He doesn't have much of a beginning, but he certainly has a very unfortunate end. And we have to come to terms with what happens to him. So that's the second problem. In other words, number one, understanding David. Number two, Uzzah. And as I mentioned before, Michal, hopefully will be able to get through all of this and try and come to terms with her comments at the end, which again are very perplexing. There's no question in my mind, she just did not understand her husband. She really didn't get it. And it's sad. There's a sadness there. There's a tremendous sense of, I don't know how to describe it, lack of fulfillment. And this goes back to what we were talking about sort of the last couple of weeks about Michal and the fact that she was sent off, as the Abarbana explained, to a guardian because her father didn't want her to stay with David. And, you know, she's being pushed around over here. She has tremendous respect for her father. She has even more respect at the beginning, certainly for David. She helps him escape and the whole story. And now you'll see it's sad. She expresses a kind of frustration. There's a terrible frustration that she just doesn't understand what David is doing. So with all of that kind of strange introduction, let's look at chapter 6, Perek Vav, page 163. And then, with a bit of luck, we'll have time just to have a look at a bit of text. As I said, this is the Haftarah for Parshat Shmini. Shmini is the story of Nadab and Avihu, along with other things, but Nadab and Avihu, the famous story of the sons of Aaron, who brought the fire into the temple and was not commanded. It says, Shalot Tzuvah. And as a result, they were absolutely killed on the spot. And Vayidom Aaron, Aaron was silent. And we know the famous story there, B'Krovaya Kadesh, God says that I'll become holy through the ones who are holy to me. And whatever that means, and the whole interpretation, again, lots of different ideas. And of course, the connection with the Haftarah, this chapter 6 is the Haftarah for Parshat Shmini, because again, we'll see B'Krovaya Kadesh. There's going to be another story of at the height of a spiritual moment, as is the story in chapter 6, we're going to see again a potential tragedy, not potential, a real tragedy within the great spiritual heights that are taking place, as it was in the story of Parshat Shmini, so it will be in chapter 6 of Shmuel Bet. So we'll learn the chapter, and then you'll see where we're going with this. And as I said, there's a number of issues that we're going to have to deal with. There's a bit of mazel. I found the Chamalevitz has a small piece on this perek, so maybe it'll be able to help us to understand it a bit better. I'm always excited when I find the Chama's writings on Novi. It just has not been produced. Her stuff on Torah has been produced, but she had stuff on everything. She gave Shurim on every perek probably in Novi that exists, but the Svarim just haven't come out. It's just not around. It's attached in her books on the Torah, in the Haftarah. So you've got little bits over there, but not on every Haftarah. It's only on a few, but thank God this one exists. So we'll show you the piece in a minute. So let's just go through the Psukim, and you'll see where we're going with this. David has finished his battle with the Plishtim. Emek Rephaim is now cleared, right? So we can now turn it into whatever Emek Rephaim is today, and go a bit further from there. Pasuk Vav, chapter Vav, Pasuk Aleph. Vayosef David et kol bachor b'Yisrael shloshim eleh. And Rashi says there's a word missing, le'esov. David gathers together all the bachor, the chosen ones of Israel, the young men of Israel, 30,000 men. So he's now going to establish his power base because he's got rid of the enemies, and now he has to go to the next stage. Remember, he's conquered Yerushalayim or parts of Yerushalayim as yet. There's a bit more to go, and now what he has to do is to bring the Jerusalem into a new status. And of course, the status will be not just the status of Jewish ownership, but of holiness. And how do you do that? There is going to be initially the one thing that he's got to do before anything else is to bring the Aron HaKodesh into Jerusalem. And this is again just a little bit of intro, because those of you who were not with me in the previous time, we saw the Aron was captured by the Plishtim, it was taken away, and they had a big problem with it, and they suffered terrible diseases because of it, and without going into the whole story, and eventually eventually they sent it back on a wagon. And it came up to Beit Shemesh, and the people of Beit Shemesh, unfortunately, did not seem to treat it with the cover that they should have done, and they started dying all over the place. And eventually it ends up in a place called Kiryat Yarim, nowadays Telstone, which is right on Kiryat Yarim, and that's where it stayed. And it stayed there for a number of years. It didn't move. And now David realizes that the next part of the process of creating the spiritual center which has to be created in Israel is to bring the Aron into Jerusalem. The Mishkan is not there. The tabernacle is still, I think it's in Givon at this point, if I'm not mistaken. That's going to stay there. It's not going to come to Jerusalem because David is now looking to go to the more permanent stage of building the temple. And that's going to be a whole issue we're going to talk about another time. So listen to this, Pasuk Beis. Vayokom vayelech David, so he goes. Vacholom ha-she'ito, b'Bale Yehuda, all the people from a place called Bale Yehuda. La'alot misham et Aron alekim, they're going to bring up the Ark of God. Asher nikra Shem, which has got the name Shem Hashem Tzvaot Yosheva HaKruvim Alav. Upon it, it was called by the name of God of hosts. There's the word Shem here is mentioned twice. So the rabbis say twice because you have the tablets, the whole tablets, and you have the broken tablets. Remember, there were two luchot, two sets. So Shem here, the idea, the Aron contained both sets of tablets, and that's why the word Shem is used here twice, right? That's one suggestion on this very kind of strange pasuk. And what do they do to bring up the Aron? V'yarkivu et Aron Elokim el agalah chadasha. So what did they do? They took a new wagon. Now, this is a bit strange. As you might remember from the Torah description, the Aron had to be carried on the shoulders. The Aron had badim, it says it had poles, rings on the side, and you put the poles through the rings, and then two people like pallbearers, you carried it on one side, on the other side, the Levim. Okay, the famous tribe of Kahat, if I'm not mistaken, who are very short. Short and stubby guys. They had kind of an interesting physique. It talks about that. I remember once hearing a shiur. I think Lenny Goldsmith spoke about it. It's one of those interesting descriptions here. Of course, we understand why David is doing this because presumably he saw it on a wagon. It was left on the wagon in the house of Aminadab, this guy in Kiryat Yarim. And one guess is that David decided that, you know, to bring it up to Yerushalayim, I'm going to put it on another wagon. But I've got to make a new wagon in order to put it on something more mechubad, more upmarket, I suppose you would say. So that's what David did. The trouble is, the Torah says you've got to carry it on your shoulders. So it's very interesting. Already, look at Rashi here on Pasuk Gimel. El Agalah Chadasha. Rashi says, Ta'a b'davar, David made a mistake. She'afilu tinokot she'beit Rabban yodim oto. Even the children of Cheder know the law, which David made a mistake. Ki avodata kodesh aleim bakatef yisav. They've got to carry it on their shoulders. Olafi she'amar zmirot. Hayuli chukecha b'beit megurai. It's a pasuk in Tehillim, which obviously is the idea that David was so desperate to get the Aron there. Ne'nash lavo lidekach. Umet Uzza al Yado. Basically, David again, his emotions, his over abundance of spirituality just became too intense. And as a result, David did not stop and say, how do I go about this correctly? David just went ahead and did what he thought he had to do. And it's almost as if he's sort of making it up as he goes along. The trouble is, it's unacceptable. David does this a number of occasions, and again, one understands. He's a guy who's basically trying to sort of, you know, chat malachim is the expression they use in Yiddish. He's trying to grab the angels. And when he's doing this, he's not thinking it through. He's not doing something which is measured. He's not doing something which, you know, you can argue that should be done in certain stages. He just wants to get the whole thing, the process going. He's pushing and pushing and pushing.
Get it done first.
And this is what David is about. It's so interesting. And of course, the problem is that leads to a tragedy. The rule is, and this is the same thing with the sons of Aaron, that they should have known that the Aish was not commanded. It was not a mitzvah to bring that fire at that time. They were impetuous. They wanted to get on with it. Some say that there's all different explanations about what was going on there. But the reality was that they overstepped the mark. And when you overstep the mark, it's not good. Especially in this case, it's really not acceptable. And Rashi says it. I mean, the way he words this, that even a child in cheder knows this. All right, particularly, you know, the tradition was to start learning, the kids would start learning Sefer Vayikra. So even the little kids, 5 or 6 years old, would already know what David seems to have forgotten, which is a bit of a comment on David, but we'll come back to that. So what did he do? He put it on a wagon. He took it from the house of Avinadav. And the sons of Avinadav, these were pretty holy guys. They accompanied it. Noah Gimet Agala Chadasha. They led the wagon. So again, this is potentially very, very fraught. I remember hearing once, I think Rabbi Goren talk about the fact that it's a great bracha today that the Oron is hidden. All right, we don't have it. According to the Radak mentioned in Melachim Aleph, he says when Shlomo built the Beit HaMikdash, he built a cavern under the Beit HaMikdash. And in that cavern, that's where they hid the Oron already at the time of Sancheriv. They hid it because they knew that there was going to be trouble in the north, and they thought that Sancheriv was going to come to the south, which he tried to. Remember, there's a tremendous miracle with Chizkiyahu, and the whole story there, so they hid the Oron. Now, there are different speculations. If you watch the National Geographic channel, they tell you the Oron, they have programs about this all the time. Some say it's in Ethiopia, some say it's in other places, who knows? The reality is, the Radak says, traditionally, it's down in the vault of the temple. And there was an interesting story. If any of you have done the tunnel tours at the Kotel, which I imagine some of you will have been through. It's a bit claustrophobic. If you're into claustrophobia, don't do it. It's a wonderful thing, but it can be a bit overpowering. When you're walking along there, I remember the first time I went along, before they opened up the end section, the guide is somebody called Rachel Druk, who was interesting. I don't know if she still does it. Very, very fascinating. And she was telling us about the whole history of that particular discovery of that tunnel. And she said, particularly at the end of the tunnel, there was a big opening. And the big opening went right inside under the Temple Mount. And a few rabbinical gentlemen at the time, when this was discovered, they decided to follow the tunnel through and went through the opening. And of course, what would have happened if they'd carried on digging, because they started digging around, is that they may have found something which would have been a bit of a problem. If they'd find this Oron, you know, what are we going to do with it? How are we going to handle it? You'll see over here, this is a very, how should we say, it's something, it's hot, it's too hot to handle. You know, this is hot merchandise. And what happened was that the Arabs, apparently, they have a staircase from the area upstairs that they can come straight down into this vault, wherever it is. They heard people sort of down below. They realized that somebody had come in from a different entrance. They came down and they had to call the police. There was nearly a riot down there. This happened 20 years ago. And as a result, they blocked off that whole entrance. So when you go along the tunnel, you don't actually have that entrance anymore to go into the Temple Mount. You just continue straight along till you get to the end, which they claim was the Shuk, where they used to sell the Master Sheni. It's an interesting thing over there. That whole tunnel tour is fascinating. But what I'm saying is that the Ark remains buried. It's lost. And to a certain extent, you know, thank God, because if we had it, I'm not quite sure what we would do with it, how we would handle it, and it's pretty scary, as you'll see from Pasuk Dalet. Look what they did. Back to Pasuk Dalet. So they carried the ark with, they went with the ark. The Achio Holech Lifnei Aaron. Achio was leading the Agala, the wagon. Hey. V'David v'chol Beit Yisrael m'sachakim Lifnei Hashem. David led the dancing, right? David was so excited. And he was so elevated, spiritually elevated. This is what I was talking about before. That is Mesachakim Lifnei Hashem. Now the trouble is Mesachakim suggests that there's a certain amount of frivolity here. That Mesachakim is not quite the same. Like we had it last week's parasha, Mesachek, right? That is with the tzadi, but sometimes it's Yitzchak, and sometimes Yitzchak is written Yischak. Okay, you'll find that his name is written in two different ways. Schok is the idea sometimes not of real simcha, but kind of frivolous simcha. Okay, the sort of thing that I suppose we indulge in, particularly on Purim and Simchas Torah. The wonderful anecdote from Samuel Pepys. Samuel Pepys was the famous diarist from England who wrote his diaries in the 1600s and was taken to visit the Jewish synagogue one day in the year in order to be able to write about Jews. So who took him? When? On Simchas Torah. They took him on Simchas Torah. So what does he write in his diary? You can read this probably online. He writes that the Jews, they are a bunch of drunks. They're a bunch of no good nicks because they're all laying around drunk on the floor like they do in Super Star. You know, it was the wrong... Had he come the next day, he would have been a bit different. Sorry.
I've seen him in England one time.
And they had Sephardi, but I guess they also had a little, imbibed a little in those days as well. It's just fascinating. You know, the one day in the year you take the guy to shul, what a day to... He should have taken Rosh Hashanah, he would have had a different impression, but that's the way it was. Very interesting thing there. All right, so again, back to Masach HaKim. So the Masach HaKim Lefnei Hashem, B'chol Atzei Brashim, they're using all of these kind of woods and whatever. I always think of, you know, when they come into the wedding and they're holding all those banners and whatever, when the Chos and Kala come in, V'chinorot and Valim, B'tupim, they're using all of these instruments, lyres and you name it, harps, psalteries, whatever those things are. But Menanim, Metzeltzelim, bells, cymbals, how do you translate all this stuff?
My
you have to go to the Gregors, right? Groggers, or whatever you call them. Vayavod Goren Nachon. So they came to a place called Goren Nachon, all of a sudden they got into a bit of bumpy ground, and you know what's happening? The ark is beginning to fall off the wagon. This is like, God forbid, you know, the Hagba, which you don't want to see, is when the guy is sort of tottering, doesn't realize that the Sefer is probably 10 times heavier than he thought it was going to be. And, you know, the guy's all of a sudden tottering and everyone goes, you know, deep breath and what's going to happen next. And I don't think I've ever had to fast for a drop set. I think I actually did once in Israel. We had that, but it's not one of those pleasant experiences. But anyway, so the ark is falling off. What do you do? So they came to Goren Nachon, Pasuk Vav, Vayishlach Uzza Laron Alekim Vayochizbo. So he holds on to it. Uzza's standing there and he wants to keep the ark on the wagon. Because the oxen have swayed, they're not keeping a straight line, and the whole thing's beginning to fall off. And at this point, the incredible thing happens, as we have in Parshat Shmini, a similar story. God became angry against Uzza, and what happened? And he was struck down there, as it says, for his error, shal means a mistake. And he died on the spot. And this, of course, was in the midst of all of this simcha and celebration and everything else. This must have been a terrible shock. And of course, what happened at this point? David was angry, seemingly because of God's breach. God made a breach against Uzza, but I think the Mefarshim explained he was angry at himself. He realized at that moment there's something terribly wrong with what was going on. And he called it by the name Peretz Uzza. It was something where Uzza, there was a break. God broke out against Uzza. Peretz means to break, to make a breach. And it's called that to this day. Now, David became very fearful of God because he realized that you can chap malachim, you can grab the angels as much as possible. You've got to do it in the right way. How am I going to bring the ark to Jerusalem? How am I going to bring it in? Because he realized that this was not right. And therefore, David did not allow the ark to come back at this point. And he sent it back to the place, to the house of Obed Edom the Gitti. And this obviously was again a gentleman who was very spiritually acceptable to be able to look after it. And it stayed there for 3 months. In the meantime, this guy Obed Edom had won the lottery, because what happened was that his house became fruitful. In other words, I guess his crops started to grow, and you know, things started to happen. It was good to have the Oron in the vicinity. It seemed to be good for him. And now, Vayugad leMelech David leMor, King David was told, saying, "Berach Hashem et Beit Oved Edom v'et Kol Hashalom." Good sign, because if there's bracha, maybe it's time to bring the ark into Yerushalayim a second time. And he says that, you know, he's getting blessed by Avor Aron Elokim because of the ark. Vayelech David vayalet Aron Elokim mibeit Oved Edom ir David b'simcha, not schok anymore, simcha. If there's Hashem b'simcha, you know, this is the real deal. David now understands that, you know, what you've got to do now is you've got to bring the ark back. It's a sign that there's been forgiveness, but you do it b'simcha, with simcha shel mitzvah, with a true sense of joy. Yeah. And it's going to be on the shoulders, as you'll see. Yeah. And this is what he says in Yud Gimel. Vayehi kitzadun nosei Aron Hashem shishat tzadin. And they made tremendous effort this time round. They walked 6 paces. And then what they do, vayizbach shomri, they made a korban. Now again, all of this was, these were nedavot, these were not required. six steps, and then they made a korban. They carried it 6 steps forward, they stopped, and they made a korban at that point. And again, you know, was it an absolute korban? It seems to be just a sacrifice was made, but obviously this was in the sense of, you know, trying to sort of make up for what they did before, trying to go in the derech which they had, which they should have gone the first time round. And at this point, David loses it. And he doesn't lose it badly, he loses it in a way that I can only say, I once read a description. The Vilna Gaon, the Gaon of Vilna, was very famous for the fact that, how many hours a day did the man sleep? Maybe 2 hours a day. I mentioned Rosh Hashanah, there's a famous statement of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who says that the Vilna Gaon, had he slept 3 hours a day, then there would have been another Jew in Paris would have assimilated. That 1 hour of Torah that he studied, the extra hour, kept a Jew somewhere in the world from becoming assimilated out of Judaism. It's an amazing statement. But basically, what the Vilna Gaon was all about was Torah study. This was not a warm and fuzzy guy. This was a guy that was enveloped in Torah study. And I guess that if you'd gone to him for a bracha, he would have given you approximately 10 seconds, and that would have been it. But on Simchas Torah, there are many descriptions of the way that he danced with the Torah. All of a sudden, the man came out of his study, and, you know, wherever the minyan was, whether it was in the shul or whether it was in his house, I don't know. And there are descriptions of the way the man danced with the Torah is just beyond belief. And those of you who have been to see Rebbe's, if you've seen, I once went to the Tish, the Toldos Aharon, which is the guy, the gold coat guys, in Yerushalayim. And the Rebbe, what happens is they all stand around on bleachers, as it were, and the Rebbe dances in the middle. So the Rebbe holds the Sefer Torah, and they're all swaying and singing and shuckling or whatever. And it's just a very unique way of doing Simchas Torah, very different to what we do in our shuls. And again, you know, when you see stuff like that, you realize that this is coming in a tradition. And the tradition is what we're reading over here. Pasuk Yud Dalet. V'David mecharker, David was dancing. Mecharker is a different word, difficult word to translate. What does Rashi say? Meraked. So Rashi translates it for you. He was dancing b'chol oz, with all of his strength, all of his might. You know, this is sort of, how should we say, this is 770, you know, when the Rebbe sort of started waving his hands around, those guys, they put every effort they could into the dancing. I mean, you've seen pictures of it, and it's just amazing. And again, there is an element here which is incredible. David mecharker b'chol oz ifnei Hashem. He's dancing with all of his strength before God. But David chagur eifobat. And as I mentioned, this is a very strange thing to say. He was wearing some sort of linen ephod. I mean, again, a very flimsy type of jacket or whatever it was. Difficult to describe. And as I said at the beginning, this so sort of matim, it fits David's description. He's now at the point of almost, I would say, you know, he's at the point of sort of like Elio, you know, he's going up to Shemayim, this guy. And at this point in time, everything physical is minimized, everything spiritual is intensified. It's just the most intense moment in his life, because he's bringing the Aron to Yerushalayim. This is part of the first stage of building the Beit HaMikdash, which is his dream, his desire, his wish, everything that David wants to achieve. And at this point in time, the interesting description on the physical side is how incredibly minimal it is what David is wearing. Okay, he's not wearing very much, let's put it that way. This becomes a big issue for Michal, for his wife, as you'll see in a minute. Pasuk Tetva. For David v'chol beit Yisrael ma'alim et Aron Hashem, the whole house of Israel is involved in bringing up the Aron, b'teruah b'kol shofar, with a truah, with a kol shofar, blowing the shofar. This is a special moment. V'hayah Aron Hashem b'ayah David, it came to the David. Now, what happens here? Michal bat Shaul. His wife is there, she's been returned to him, remember, from a few weeks ago. And nishkafa bat achalom. Interesting word. Hashkifa memon kodshom min hashamayim. It's a word, we use the word a lot today, hashkafa. But nishkafa literally means to look out. But nishkafa, you'd say, the word in Hebrew, that Michal is looking out, should normally be lirot, to see. But it's not. This is nishkafa. She is looking in the sense of, how should we say, she's looking with a kind of intense look. She doesn't appreciate what David is doing. As far as she is concerned, David dancing around like whatever, like some sort of crazy guy, as far as she's concerned, is belittling the whole status of the king. And she just doesn't get it. And it says, Vatered Melech David, she saw King David, it stresses Melech, in the status of being a king, mefazez, mecharkeh lifnei Hashem. He's dancing around, jumping up and down like a lunatic. Vativez lo beliba, and she despised him in her heart. And again, as I said before, we have to understand what's going on here. Why is she so taken aback with David? Why is she so tivez, a very strong word. It means to despise, to loathe. And she is just unable to come to terms with the behavior that David seems to have. This is Simchas Torah, the greatest Simchas Torah you've ever had in your life. With Purim thrown in and with a lot of other things thrown in, all at one shot. And she just doesn't get it. And my first suggestion, as I said before, is to say that she doesn't understand his derech of Avodas Hashem. She doesn't know where David is coming from. She knows who David is. She understands what David, you know, the sort of all the stories and what her involvement and everything else. But this is a side of David's character that she's just, I think she's never seen before. And she just doesn't know what he's doing. As far as she's concerned, he is showing himself really to, he's belittling himself and particularly the position that he has as the king of Israel. And of course, you have to add that her father, Shaul, was much more controlled. You never saw Shaul getting into this circumstance like this. You never saw Shaul, the words being used over here. He was never mefazez, mecharkeh. He never did all that stuff. Shaul was very controlled, yeah.
I think also that's why we're Bat
Shaul. And it stresses. Excellent. Excellent. It's something here. She is coming from a royal home. And she's seen the way kings behave. This is. I mean, again, what am I reminded of? The British royalty. The British royalty is in real trouble. They've got a gentleman, one of the grandsons of the Queen. You probably heard about this guy dressed up, unfortunately, as a Nazi. The guy, what's his name? Harry. Harry is a wild cannon. And I had a bit of experience. I haven't met him, but I was teaching in a school in London, which he was meant to come to. And I remember at the time, the whole school was sort of bubbling about this. Harry is going to be one of the boarders at the school, it was a boarding school. And then he decided, no, he was going to go to another school, and they all breathed a sigh of relief. You know, when you get a guy like that who is just uncontrollable, what did the Queen do in the end? She sent him off to the army, because at least the army will give him some sort of, you know, menschlichkeit. Otherwise, this guy was not a mensch. He really was wild. And it's so interesting that within the royalty, there's a certain expectation of behavior. And Michal Bat Shaul has that expectation from her parents' home, from her father's home, and she sees David, and this is, as you say in Yiddish, it's pasnish. All right, this is really pasnish as far as she's concerned. What is he doing? And look how it goes on. It's so interesting. They have a conversation after this, but you'll see in a minute. Pasi Yud Zayin. Vayaviu et Aron Hashem. They bring the oro. Vayatzigo ta bimkomo. They put it in his place. So this is obviously a whole ceremony, like we do with the Sefer Torah. We bring the Sefer Torah in, and we put it in a certain place. Betocha ohel Hashem atalo. David made a special oro. This is not the old moed. This is just a tent, obviously, to hide it so that people will not look at it, because David realized that was part of the problem before. Vayal David olot livnei Hashem ushlamim, and of course you have to bring sacrifices just in order to get closer to God at this moment. This is a moment where you have to capitalize. I remember once, Maharosh Yeshiva spoke about, not this story, but the story of the Sotah and the Nozit. And it's a similar concept. The Sotah, it says, the woman who's suspected of adultery. She drinks the water. And the next parsha of the Torah talks about the Nozit. And the rabbis asked, why is the story of the Nozit, the Nazirite, next to the story of the Sotah, the woman who is suspected of adultery, who goes through a certain process to find whether she's innocent or guilty? And the rabbis say that Mishara Sotah B'Kukula, if you see the Sotah going through this process, Yazir Asmin Ayayin should become a Nozit. So my Rosh Hashiva, Moshe Schwab, asked, what's Pshat? What does it mean? So he said there are moments in spiritual life where you just have to build on it. When you see something which elevates you, which inspires you, something which you know gives you a certain oomph, gives you an uplift, then you just don't let it pass. You've got to do something to, as it were, you know, capitalize on it. So you see this Sota going through this process, and you see an incredible nace. She takes the water, which has the Shem Hashem, and whether she's proved innocent or guilty is the whole process there. And you've seen that, you've got to do something. You've got to react. And Judaism is not about philosophizing so much, it's much more about doing. So what do? You become a Nazi, you become a bit holier for a short period of time in order to sort of establish that influence within your life. And I think this is what's going on here. David is, again, at this moment of bringing the Aron into Yerushalayim, he's doing so many things all at once in order to make this an incredible event. For him, this is stage number one, probably one of the great stages of building the temple, and he's making the most of it. But as I said, Michal doesn't get it. And look at Pasuk Yudchet. Vayechal David me'alot ola v'ashlamim. David stops all the sacrifice at this point. Vayevarech et am b'shem Hashem tzvaot, and he makes this tremendous brocha. And again, Ashrei ha'ozen. You know, if you hear such a thing from David HaMelech, it must have been incredible. And then what happens? Vayechalek lecholam lecholamon Yisrael me'ish ad ishai le'ish chalat lechem achad. He then gives out shirayim. It's the Rebbe, you know, this is Hasidic stuff here. He's giving away a loaf of bread to some of the people there, to the men. And the Eshbar Echad, and also whatever Eshbar is, I've forgotten now here, it says a portion of meat, Vashisha Echad, and a barrel of wine. So he's giving away, you know, sort of souvenirs to take home because he realizes that people will remember this by the, you know, what you take home. You like that, you get sort of at a dinner, you get the souvenirs that you take home. Vayelech kol ha'am ish lebeito, everybody left at that point. And this must have been, wow, this was the event of the century as far as they're concerned. Now we've got an interesting thing. Vayoshev David levarech et beito, David comes to bless his home, his household, his children, etc. He's going to give them a bracha at this point. He is elevated. He's itaruta de la'ela. You know, he's really spiritually, he's charged up. Vateitse Michal bat Shaul, again, stressing who she is. Michal, the daughter of Shaul, went out, likrat David, towards David. And she is going to give him her a piece of her mind. Vatoman, she says, and it's kind of all, you know, there's a lot of sarcasm here. There's a lot of pain. Ma nichbad ayom. Melech Yisrael, she doesn't call him David. O King of Israel, what is so honorable today, Asher niglah hayom le'nei mahot avadah, that you have become, as it were, revealed to the servants, to the women, the servants, the higalod niglod achadarekim, as if you are one of the empty ones. In other words, she's basically saying to him, David, you brought yourself into disrepute. She doesn't understand remotely what David was doing. That's the nishkafa. Nishkafa, the idea of looking in a critical way at David. And of course, David says, you know, what do you want from my life? Vayomer David el Michal, lifnei Hashem asher bechar bi me'avicha michol beito. God chose me from your father and from all his house, the tzavoto ti nagid al am Hashem al Israel, to become the leader, the king over the people. V'sichakti lifnei Hashem, and I made merry. I was mesachek before Hashem. All right, and of course, this is an interesting word that he uses, which was the one problem I had with this, because surely it should have said v'samachti lifnei Hashem. So v'sichakti, maybe he just wants to play it down a bit. You know, that at this point in time, there had to be joy, and there had to be a certain amount of dancing, and he doesn't want to maybe get into the whole discussion with her of his spiritual approach. So he says, Sichakti. I did something which I felt was important in order to increase the joy, the fun that people felt, the fun that people were experiencing, the joy. V'nakaloti od mizot, and he said that if I would be more demean than this, I'll just go with the translation. Vayiti shafal beinai. I will be, as it were, lower in my own eyes. V'im imahot asher mart imam ikaveda. And even more than the maidservants of which you spoke to give me honor. In other words, basically what he's saying is that as far as he was concerned, had he not done this, he would have even brought himself into more disrepute. Because his expectation, or certainly his estimation, was to explain to Michal that everybody expected David to be the life and soul of the party. It's a bit like the Rav on Simchas Torah. You know, you expect the rabbi to be doing the dancing and leading the dancing, and that's always a you know, situation. And it's one of those things that at this point in time, David is basically saying, Michal, just understand that if I hadn't done this, it would have been a lot worse. She refuses to get it. And what is so tragic is that she just does not get him. Michal bat Shaul ayala yelet ad yom mota. She had already had children, but from this point onward, no more children. There was no, in the sense that she had not understood the tremendous simcha, the sense of joy that David had experienced, and as a result, she was punished with this because she criticized him so much that she never experienced the simcha of childbirth from that moment onwards till the day she died. It's unbelievable. Again, Michal, very difficult to come to terms with it. Very difficult to understand. I just want to show you this piece of Nechama very, very quickly. It's not a complicated piece, but just about Uzzah. I'm just going to give this out very... I don't know if you have a minion. Rustle up another chair. Pass these around. You just have a look. It's in the vernacular, so I got the English version here. So I'm not going to go maybe a bit into Michal at this point, but I just want to show you what Nechama says about at least the story about Uzzah. And yeah, yeah. Which I think is this thing of Simcha. I think it's really about this. Masameach, and she lost that privilege after that. It's very tragic. Michal is really, as I said, one of these tragic figures because, you know, she's going according to her own instinct of where she's coming from, who she is, her background, everything else. And in the end, you know, as I said at the beginning, this is what I really believe, is that she just did not understand her husband. She didn't know what he was about. What you see over here is a comparison between section A on the right-hand side, the story when the people of Beit Lechem were killed by the Aron when it returned to Israel for the first time. And then on section B on the other side, where it says, it talks about the explanation of that particular story. The basic point the Chama makes is at the bottom here. It's the last paragraph, the second to last paragraph, which begins perhaps, and I'll just read this very quickly. It's on the left-hand side, about just over halfway down. Perhaps we may now understand wherein lay Uzzah's sin, when he put forth his hand to support the ark of God from the ox and stumbled, right? Remember, that's what we saw. He tried to stop the ark falling off. He thought it was up to him to rescue the sacred appurtenance from desecration, not by carrying out the will of God, which had forbidden him to touch it, but by stopping the ark from slipping down. So he made his own calculation how to stop it. And of course, he should have realized that this had a different dynamic. The ark should have been carried on the shoulders. The rabbis explained that, in fact, you didn't actually feel anything because it carried itself. It had its sort of its own whatever you want to call it, its own dynamism. But he says, but not for the falling down of the ark, the piece of the furniture from the cart, but rather the violation of what was said on that within the ark in the Torah constituted the real desecration. In other words, the people unfortunately thought, as they did when they took the ark to battle, that the ark was a secret weapon of the Jews, and it really wasn't. It was about what was inside it, and it was about the connection that Am Yisrael had to the words of Torah. If they respected what was in the ark, then the ark was strong for them. If they didn't, and they didn't respect the details of the Aron, then it worked against them. And this is the whole deal. And she says, to impress this upon us, the Lord himself brought the ark low and sent it into captivity, handed over to the Philistines. That's what happened the first time, indicating that the ark itself is not intrinsically holy, nor is God necessarily with him who possesses the ark. Me'er Simcha Devinsk, and he brings the Meshech Chochma over here, who says the same thing. The paragraph on the right hand side, I'm sorry, the photocopy is not very good. Accordingly, the taking of the ark with him into battle was no indication of true submission to him. Proof of this, the ark did not save them, but fell into captivity. Nor is the support of the ark to save it from falling when touch of it is prohibited, a token of respect for the will of God, but rather rebellion against him. This is the point. Uzzah, in the moment where he should have, you know, been elevated to the highest level of observance, unfortunately does something which is considered to be rebellious, and he's punished immediately. And it says, for this reason the Lord struck him down. It's very difficult to understand, but this is back to what we said with the sons of Aaron, the same thing. That at this moment of great spiritual elevation, the last thing that is allowed or is encouraged is a deviation from the instructions. If you follow the instructions, you won't, you know, it's like lighting the gunpowder. It won't blow up in your face. If you don't follow the instructions, then Nebuchadnezzar can backfire. And this is really what Nechama says, based on the Abarbanel. You can, if you want to take this away, you can look at this yourselves and see exactly what she says here. This was a in a sense, an act of Avodah Zarah, because they thought the ark had so much power within it that they didn't understand that the whole power of the ark, of the Aron, was really the observance of what was inside the Aron. Not necessarily what the Aron itself represented, but what was inside the Luchot, and the fact that Am Yisrael observed the details of everything that was written in the Torah. If they did it, then this ark would not have been held up by Uzzah in this way. It would not have been brought in this way. Everything that was done here, David realized, he immediately rectifies the situation. Within 3 months, they bring it back properly. But of course, the story of Uzzah is a very great warning about, you know, doing things the right way. Compromising in Sivui Hashem is really one of the most dangerous things that people did. We see it again and again. And it's one of those things that they paid a heavy price. What we'll see, Bezrat Hashem, next week, God willing, is a bit more about Michal. We'll look a bit at Perek Zion. We're going to step up the pace because the next couple of chapters are a bit more sort of bland, I suppose I would call them, although the one or two things we need to say. We might even get to David and Bathsheba even before the winter break that's coming upon us in a few weeks' time. But if not, then certainly that will be on the cards for January. So it's really something to look forward to, I hope. In the meantime, an interesting chapter, something really quite extraordinary. Have a good evening, everybody. Thank you.